Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 96 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna, and I'm your host today. And in this episode, I will be sharing an interview I did with the wonderful Tion Paris, who we'll learn about more in the episode, but essentially is a member of the History Matters editorial team, a coordinator in the Young Historians Project, and a PhD candidate looking at radical black women in the US and black power movements. In this episode, we will be talking about so many women that not only worked in the US actually, but crossed over into Britain at a variety of points in their life and in their careers. Some of those names you might be familiar with and some of them you may not be. Claudia Jones being one of them, Aslanda Robeson, Angela Davis, Vicky Garvin, Louise Thomas Patterson, just to name a few of the people we'll be speaking about today. And this episode, it kind of like hits two series at the kind of intersection as we get to this middle point of Black History Month in the US, still thinking about some of these US histories that kind of cross and connect with the UK, but also with the fact that we have a little ongoing series that is less frequent. Episodes kind of come out every month with the History Matters editorial team, where we have members of that team sharing their work. And I think the majority of the team look at Black British history, but Tion's work crosses over into the US, and I thought it would be perfect to have her on this month as we are thinking about some of elements of US history, more so because it is February. So without further ado, let us get into this episode. I hope you enjoy it. I genuinely learned so much from the conversation, as I do with every conversation I have with Tion. But yeah, today's episode, I think you're in for a treat, if I do say so myself. We have Tion Paris with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm really excited to get into kind of your research, your work with History Matters Journal, with Young Historians Project as well. And I think it kind of comes at a perfect time because your work does cross over into looking at Black power and radicalism, especially within women in the US as well. And obviously it is Black History Month in America at the moment. So I thought it would be perfect to have you on this month as part of this kind of crossover, looking at the two places. So I thought that I would just introduce Tion and tell you a little bit about her work, just so you know who we have on the show today. So Tion Paris is part of the editorial board of the History Matters Journal and has been part of the journal team since 2021. She's also a PhD candidate in history at the University of Hertfordshire and a coordinator at the Young Historians Project. She's a specialist in African American history and specifically in the Black Power movement of the 1960s and 70s. Her current PhD research concerns the ideological connections between Black radical women of the early 20th century and the Black Power movement of the latter half of the 20th century in the United States and internationally. The study is interested primarily in the transfer of tactics and ideology, as well as the interpersonal and intergenerational exchange between activists. So it's very, very good to have you, Tion.
Thank you. That's a great introduction.
Oh, no, absolutely. I was thinking before we were recording, when we first met, and it was actually thinking about radical Black women for the Lawrence Wishart Publishing talk, I think it was in 2021.
Yep.
And literally since then, I have been welcomed into the Young Historians Project and other wonderful writing groups and things like that. So Tian is a very, 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 very wonderful person at bringing people together for historical purposes.
Thank you. Really grateful.
So I thought we'd start just by getting to know you a little bit better with some quick fire questions, mm-hmm. as we always do. Why did you decide to study history? At what point was that a thing for you?
So I can tell you, it's a bit of a long story, but I'm going to try and shorten it. So I, listeners may notice, I have a Scottish accent. So I grew up in Scotland. My dad is African-American and my mum is white Scottish. But I didn't have that African-American influence directly from my dad in my life. So my mum, as I was growing up, was very, very on it and made a real effort to sort of make sure that we, my sister and I, understood sort of African-American culture. We were brought up with the music, with movies, and also with history. So that was obviously part of our heritage, that as we were growing up and learning about Scottish heritage, my mum made a real effort to make sure that we knew our African-American heritage as well. So that was part of my life when I was growing up. And then my flashpoint and the thing I always point to is that when I was 13, my mum bought me the autobiography of Malcolm X. And that was where everything sort of changed for me, because for a long time, I'd been aware of like Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. But I hadn't known much about Malcolm X. And then that kind of opened Pandora's box into radicalism, because I sort of understood that there was another path that was taken. And then also being a teenager, that led me down the rabbit hole of the Black Panther Party, who I'm sure a lot of Black teens can agree it was you know, very aesthetically cool. I liked very the cool. ideas that they had. Yeah. And they just, like, I mean, you couldn't get away from it as a teenager. It's just like the coolest group of people to look at, but also to hear them speak, and their boldness was something that really stuck with me. So when I was in high school, I decided I wanted to try and do as much of Malcolm X and radicalism as I could, even though it wasn't really on the curriculum. And I did the same thing through my undergrad and my master's. So I always sort of chose the radical path to study, and that's how I ended up here.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. I love that story. No, definitely. And I think it's interesting. I think a lot of people do start with the US when it comes to kind of being introduced to Black history more broadly, even in Britain, and even without having like African-American like family members or influences in your life. So it's kind of interesting. You've come kind of from a similar place as a lot of us, probably a lot of people listening as well. But interesting that it was Malcolm X that you were kind of introduced to, and that changed things for you, because a lot of people kind of get introduced to like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and maybe less radical individuals when it comes to the US.
And one of the interesting things with Malcolm X was as well, like, his name Malcolm Little came from a Scottish kind of background. So as a Scottish Black sort of teen, I was like, whoa, we're connected in ways that I didn't even think of.
Oh, wow.
That was also part of the draw.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, you know, being Scottish, there wouldn't be necessarily a clear link you could see otherwise. Wow, very, very interesting that. Okay, so what then is your favourite historical time period? This can be, you know, what you study or just generally what you like.
So I think if you'd asked me a few years ago, I'd obviously say it's the Black Power movement. It's the 1960s and 70s. But interestingly, when I kind of thought about this question, it was I was kind of struck by the fact that I'm more interested now in the 1950s, because I think so much happens then that I guess you don't really learn of in school. Like, for example, there's sort of political activism that happens before the civil rights movement that is really gearing up in that decade. And there's loads of radical groups as well in the US, like the Civil Rights Congress. And there's kind of the fracturing of the Communist Party, which I have to mention as a communist historian. And then just the trajectory as well of loads of activists in that decade. You can see where there's kind of splits and where the sort of 1960s ends up. You can see the beginnings of that happening in the 1950s. And also just finally, there's things like the Bandung Conference as well in 1955, where you see sort of Asian African solidarity being built before it kind of happens in the 1970s with the Third World alliances that happen then. So there's just lots and lots that could be said about the 1950s that I've learned more and more in the last couple of years that has really changed my favorite period.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's important because all of these kind of really big moments, as you said, the 60s that we kind of think about, there's always a build up, you know, there's always like decades sometimes of history that comes before that that leads to these moments. It's interesting. I'm reading now about the 1930s and early 40s as a kind of quote-unquote Windrush historian, and seeing the kind of things that happen beforehand, and the kind of movements that are taking place, and the kind of bits of policy that are kind of creeping in to lead up to the moment of like 1948 or the 1950s or 60s. It is really important, actually.
Exactly.
Very interesting you said that. Who would you say, and I know your research does look at individuals quite a lot, but if you had to pick one, who would be your favourite historical figure?
See, this is a hard question because I feel like I am offending some of the women in my study if I don't choose them. I think, so Islanda Robeson is someone that I'm currently very infatuated with, I think. She's sort of lesser known out of a lot of the women. Like Claudia Jones is another one in my project. But Islanda Robeson is a person that I'm just so interested in. Because as a Black woman in the 20th century, she was a scientist who then became an anthropologist. Wow. And then she travels to Africa by herself with her 8-year-old son. And this is in the 1930s. And she travels across various countries in Africa and writes about them from the lens of trying to kind of break down European colonialist views of Africa and things that she'd been taught as an African-American about Africa. She refers to it as like her homeland as well. And this is in the 1930s. It's very Pan-Africanist of her, kind of before that becomes a huge movement. And then also as an observer of international politics as well, I'm interested in the way that she kind of analyzes things like the founding of the United Nations. She has a lot to say about that as an African-American, and she has a lot to critique about that as well. And she critiques other African-American women. So I kind of, I'm just so interested in her. She's a really interesting character. And one of the funny things about her is that she was never really afraid of anything. She stood up to various senators and lawmakers who tried to accuse her of being a communist. Mm-hmm. She writes these very witty articles about being attacked as a supposed communist. And then she said the only thing she was ever afraid of was cats. So I really love that. Like, you said that to sort of senators in the House. Yeah. And that is just so bold. And I aspire to be that, I don't know, that strong one day. But yeah. I see
except
that
for cats.
Yeah. No, I don't mind cats too much.
Maybe you're in better stead. Oh, wow. Do you, just thinking about, I know Islanda Robeson comes up in your PhD work as well. Did you start then thinking about some of these?
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Turn your tax refund into a new kitchen with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Renovate your space with new cabinets from Cardell. They're ready to install and come in a variety of styles and finishes with free shipping to your home. Visit our kitchen showrooms in-store or go to Menards.com for free estimates today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of our hot deals going on now.
Save big money at
women and some of their lives, or did you start looking at, as you said, like radicalism and then these women kind of fit into that? Like, what came first?
So it worked backwards, actually. So my master's was on the prison abolitionist movement in the 1960s and 70s in the US. So Angela Davis was a huge kind of central figure in that thesis.
Yep.
And what I was interested in was the fact that Angela Davis obviously is an icon now, and I thought it was interesting that that was the only woman I knew of. And one of the parts of her autobiography, she mentions that the prison or the jail that she was first put in, she requested books, and they might have been the books of Claudia Jones. And I was like, hold on, what? Then I kind of read backwards from there and realized that, you know, there's a lot more to be known about Black communist women and Black radical women in particular. And the way that there is a kind of lineage and a direct line you can draw through the 20th century of these women who came before Angela Davis and did a lot of work that now we are just now kind of unearthing.
Yeah, Absolutely. That's so interesting. And yeah, they are all, of course, connected, and probably, I'm sure there are more connections to draw out between the work of these women and how they would have influenced each other as well. Mm-hmm. So that's, we've gone with Islanda Robeson as your favourite. Is there a historical figure you wish more people knew about?
Can I pick one from my...
Of course you can, yeah, definitely.
Okay. So I think Vicky Garvin, who is one of the women in my project, she was a union activist and also part of the Communist Party. But in terms of the network of women that I look at, she's one who's been, I think, slightly less studied. There's a lot of small piece kind of articles about her and a lot of like journal articles that are really interesting. But I pray for a full biography of her one day. Mm. I'm not convinced I will be the person to write it, but I can't wait to see the kind of entirety or the totality of her life. Because it's so interesting. She joins the National Negro Labour Council in the 1950s, and she's part of a lot of sort of delegations and is involved with the women in my project. And then she also, she hosts Malcolm X in Accra in Ghana in 1964 and has a good relationship with him. And then she goes off and lives in China and is the sort of black left representative of African Americans there. So she lives this really interesting life where she stays in a bunch of different places across the world. I can't wait for there to be more out there about her.
Definitely. I mean, she's not a woman that I had heard of until you said it today. So hopefully speaking about her on this, or maybe there's someone out there listening that's going to write that book, or maybe you're going to do it, Tion. You never know.
No,
none at all. I think we've got enough of that doing PhDs. Right, so you are a member of the History Matters editorial team, and I just wondered how you kind of came into contact with History Matters. Why is it you decided to join, and how it kind of, you know, influences your work or impacts the work that you do?
That's a great question. So I joined History Matters. I was part of the Young Historians Project first. Yeah. And I was approached to join History Matters because I was aware of it, but I hadn't been involved kind of behind the scenes yet. And obviously as a historian, someone who is doing a PhD in Britain, kind of linkages to Black Britain as well. I think the people at History Matters were like, yeah, this makes sense, sort of bring me in.
Yeah.
And I think for me as a historian who looks a lot at magazines and newspapers and independent publishing amongst Black left kind of groups, I thought it would be really interesting to see what goes on behind the scenes, to see the kind of machinations behind producing a publication. And then also there's the community aspect, kind of being able to ally with like-minded historians who are also passionate about sharing these underserved histories. So that was how I joined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, definitely. And it, how has the kind of insight been then, being kind of behind the scenes of a journal like History Matters? Have you noticed anything, or can you like not necessarily draw similarities to the like journals and publications that you read, but are there any things that have been interesting to note?
I think the main thing is the sheer amount of work and meetings that go into putting these things together. I guess I've never thought of the various steps that it takes, the various decisions that have to be discussed. And then, of course, seeing the range of submissions that come in is for me really interesting, because I think that for me anyway, as a historian who has largely focused on the US and now sort of looking more internationally, I will admit I did not know enough about Black British history. And that is also like kind of an indictment on the curriculums that we are taught. But also interestingly, as someone who grew up in Scotland, which is somewhat culturally different in a lot of ways, I never gravitated towards Black British history because it just felt very London-centric and a very different culture than the one that I'd grown up with. So I think being part of the History Matters Journal has been a real learning exercise for me as well. Like, I learn as much from the submissions and from the various sort of contacts that we make within the journal, as well as sort of helping to put it together. So it's a really rewarding experience.
I definitely find that interesting, especially to the point of like knowing about Black British history, because History Matters Journal is kind of focused on the African Caribbean people in Britain and the kind of things they've done and moments and events and whatever else. But as you said, I think initially as well, and maybe now I think we're getting a bit better with regional histories when we think about Black British history, but not, you wouldn't see Scotland. And it's interesting that we say Black British history as opposed to like Black English history, mm-hmm. To include Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. But how much of that history do we actually ever talk about? Like I don't think I could tell you anything about Scotland except for, is there a footballer played for Celtics?
Yeah, I can't remember the name now, but yes.
No, Arthur Wharton? No. Tull? Walter Tull? One of them. I can't remember. Yep. Sorry. I'm not going to edit it in because that'll make me look good. And I didn't know.
I definitely know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
I've heard it before.
Yeah, literally. But that's it. That's all I can put on for Scotland and Black Scottish history. Mm-hmm. Do you think, I know you're not like based in Scotland at the moment, but mm-hmm. is there an effort in Scotland to bring in Black histories, or is it quite different with the way things are going there?
So I don't know anyone that's sort of school age in Scotland, so I couldn't tell you. But when I was at school, which was, not 10 years ago. God, I'm not that old. eight-ish years ago, our curriculum was entirely African-American, if there was any Blackness in it.
Okay.
So there was nothing about Black Britain. So things that happened, you know, I guess when we talk about Black Britain in the sense of sort of regular curriculums, it's always kind of England that they look at. There was nothing like that in my curriculum. And even what we did get of Blackness was the civil rights movement. And that was it. So again, still very, very limited. And I think part of it is that in Scotland, there just isn't a huge amount of research that's been done into Black Scotland. I mean, we have obviously sort of first and second generation immigrant communities who have come and are Black, but in terms of sort of, I guess, native Black, there's not a huge amount that's been done.
Yeah, I think because the focus on Black British history for so long has been quite 20th century and even later, it does exclude probably any earlier histories, and regional histories are even further behind that. Mm-hmm. But then I'm thinking, just mentioning Scotland, I think the only links of Scotland that I would maybe consider being part of like Black British history would be links to slavery and Scotland's links in different parts of the Caribbean. Yeah. And so that is, in terms of teaching a curriculum, that is a really limited scope. And again, I think Black people are fed up of seeing themselves just as enslaved. So there is an element of that as well that probably would come about in Scotland. But it'd be interesting to see if things change in Scotland at all, or have changed for like people in school and what they're learning after, especially 2020 and all the kind of calls that have come out of that.
Sure. And I think it's particularly difficult as well because of Scotland would have to atone for a lot of its involvement in slavery as well, which is something that I guess generally in Scotland, there's a vibe that it's a lot more progressive, a lot more accepting. Racism is not as well. It's not really allowed. Of course, it's not allowed anywhere, but it's less acceptable there. But to kind of dig up these colonial links or these linkages to slavery as well opens up another kind of worms. So it is a really sort of difficult thing to unpick. And I don't know what research is being done there already. Maybe in 10 years' time, I'll go back.
Or there's probably someone listening that's screaming like, why don't you know about this person? They're doing the work. There's probably a few people.
I'm sure.
Probably shouting names. If you do have any names, just send them to us on Twitter. Yeah, absolutely. Just thinking about then your work with the US, and as we mentioned, the History Matters Journal being kind of looking at Black British history. How does your work cross over, or does it cross over into Black Britain?
It definitely does. So I think when I first started my PhD, I had a very kind of insular bubble view of what I was going to be looking at. And I thought, well, I'm going to look at, you know, African-Americans in America and what they did there. But as the project has gone along, it's just they've all spidered out in their visit in Africa and China and their visit in Britain. And I think Amelia said on the previous episode as well, she mentioned the British Black Power movement, which obviously had a huge kind of influence from the American Black Power movement. And I remember one of the real kind of light bulb moments when I first joined the Young Historians Project as well was a picture of Zainab Abbas, who was part of the British Black Power movement, and she was standing next to Kathleen Cleaver. And I found some information about how they'd both attended events together. And I just thought, oh, okay, so this is all interconnected. There is no way you can sort of divorce Britain and America and their histories because they're really intertwined. And even more than that, the sort of global diasporic experience is all woven into that as well. So it's been really eye-opening. And again, every contribution I see from people who submit to the History Matters Journal just kind of broadens my horizons of the kind of histories and the ways that they're connected.
Absolutely, definitely. And when you kind of mention all that, I'm just thinking, you mentioned some of the women that you look at and the kind of breadth of the globe that they've traveled, whether it be the Soviet Union or to China. Or
you ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us. For more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
To parts of Africa, the Caribbean, you know, that's all the continents, well, majority of them, around the world. And as you've said, it would be weird for you not to kind of be kind of getting into these global connections and the global elements of mm-hmm. Black power as well. I think it's important, and I think I've said it before on this podcast, that like no movement for like Black liberation happens in a vacuum. They're mm-hmm. all part of a bigger struggle or movement or uprising that doesn't just start in the one area that it might end, or the kind of conference is presented or that speech is given. There's always so much more to it, and I think your work really speaks to that quite well.
I was gonna say, if I had to point anyone to a specific example of this, you don't really have to look any further than the West Indian Gazette, run by Claudia Jones. There are so many examples of her turning a lens to global issues and talking about things, and they're being kind of translated and transmitted to Black people in Britain. And the idea is to sort of bring them in and show there's a global community that we are all a part of.
Yeah, definitely. And even I think maybe we don't think about it so much with the later migrations to Britain in the kind of Windrush era. But when you look at some of the like West Indian intellectuals, as they're known, coming over in the like 20s and 30s, they remain, I think, with one leg in the Caribbean and one leg in Britain, and maybe even another limb in America and one in Africa. Like mm-hmm. there's never a, I don't think you can separate the two places or the three or four spaces. They're always connected because we are, as an African diaspora, always going to be connected mm-hmm. to one another, despite the divisions that people might want to try and create in the more present day. But especially looking back to the kind of era and the time period that you look at, it's very clear that these links are there and very much make sense.
Yep. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Thank you.
That was great.
I tried. Okay. I wanted to think more about your work, but specifically about an article that you wrote on Claudia Jones and Black radicalism in Britain for the History Matters Journal. And I think it was interesting for me because whenever I've looked at Claudia Jones, it's very much been from a perspective of Britain. And looking at her contributing to British history. And so that means looking at West Indian Gazette, as you said, or Carnival, or like race relations in West London and Notting Hill. But I think you started off that article really kind of pushing the point that there is so much more to Claudia Jones than any one aspect of her life as a Trinidadian woman, as a woman in America, as a woman as part of the Communist Party, you know, as a writer, as this, as that. There's so many more elements to her. I wondered if you could speak on the kind of the way in which I think history is kind of watered down her politics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, take it away.
So I think it is a really interesting thing to kind of think about the many different ways that we view Claudia Jones. And there's kind of, I like to think of it as like a prism, like there's various different sides to it, but they should all come out together into one stream. And that is kind of what I was trying to, I guess, capture at the beginning of that article, to kind of point out the fact that we seem to only view her in segments. So for us in Britain, we view her as obviously involved with Carnival, with the West Indian Gazette. And then in the US, they have a very different view of her, where they are talking about her involvement with the Communist Party and her work as a theoretician in the Communist Party and the writing that she did there. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm particularly interested in trying to take it all as one. And there's other historians as well who are doing really great work in looking at her impact in China or her travels to China. I think that was the main thing that I wanted to get from the article, was to point out, A, how she is sort of more than just one thing. She's more than just the Claudia Jones that was in Britain, the Claudia Jones that was in the US, and the Claudia Jones who traveled everywhere. These were all the same person. Yeah. And the impact as well that she had was not just on Britain and not just on America. It was, you know, with all of the people who circulated and traveled globally in that sort of the decade between 1950s and 1960s in particular. I ended my article with a photo of Malcolm X, who holds a copy of the West Indian Gazette, because he was supposed to meet with her. And I think that is a real moment in history. It's like, well, what if it had just been different? Like, how would this have ended if she had not passed away and she had actually met him? Like, how would that have changed who he was? How would that have changed? Like, what would she have done in the years afterwards?
Yeah.
So it's one of those big what ifs that I love to sort of mull over and think about, because I think when you consider that kind of titan of civil rights history, Malcolm X, being connected to Claudia Jones, you really can sort of broaden the perspective of who had helped kind of influence even him to the point that he had gotten to, and what he might have thought and might have done had he met her.
Oh, could you imagine? The timing of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and had she maybe been in the US still, or I've never let my brain wander to that place.
Yeah,
but now you say it, and I think an interesting point about Claudia Jones, and I'm asking this purely because I just want to know, I don't know how interesting that might be for everybody else, but she's a member of the Communist Party in the US and obviously quite high up, and you know, that is all a thing, but then when she comes to Britain, she's not really welcomed into the like Communist Party of Great Britain. Why is that essentially?
So I think there's a few different strands as to how that has been explained. So one strand is that people think that when Claudia came to Britain, it would have been unreasonable to have given her like such a high up position straight away in the British Communist Party.
Okay.
Mainly because it's, you know, a different kettle of fish. I don't think they had reckoned as much with the question of race in Britain at that point, or they hadn't quite made the strides that the American Communist Party had made. Just as an example, I mean, they'd been talking about black belt theory and the idea of black self-determination since the 1920s. So Claudia Jones had been part of the Communist Party from like the 1930s onwards. When she came to Britain, that was a good 20 years afterwards. So she had kind of cut her teeth with the extremes of African-American experience and American racism. So Britain was a completely different kettle of fish, I think. And so for her to have immediately joined the Communist Party and been given, you know, secretary of the entire party, I think would have been a difficult transition for everyone. So that is one strand. I think the other one is that she obviously had a lot of organizing experience and had a lot of opinions, a lot of things that she wrote about. And I think, again, it kind of comes back to that difficulty with, well, how would we deal with this? How do we bring her in? How do we make her comfortable and also make ourselves comfortable with this sort of new perspective at the party? So I think that's also a difficulty that the CPGB, the Communist Party of Great Britain, would have faced. And then finally, I think for Claudia Jones, she personally, I think she'd been through so much at that point as well. One of the first things that she apparently said when she got off the train at Victoria, when she got to Britain, was, "I'm ready to work." So she really came here with a spirit of, you know, getting involved immediately in activism here. And I think sort of for better or worse, she had her own path to tread. I think if she had joined the Communist Party of Great Britain and been really high up, I think she actually would have been limited. I think the way that she created community and the way that she created her own organizations and worked with women like Amy Ashwood Garvey, who wasn't in the Communist Party, for example, I think it gave her a lot more freedom to kind of do the things that she needed or felt she wanted to do. And I think we're lucky for that, because I don't think everything has to go by the book. I don't think that she had to join whatever organization or, you know, officially be part of XYZ to do the work that she did. And I'm glad that she forged her own way with that.
Yeah, most definitely. That makes complete sense. As you said, I think the work that she did do and all that she achieved in in a place that really wasn't necessarily her home. I mean, it became her home, but she didn't really have an experience of Britain to then come here, you know, move here, like work here, live here, set up the West Indian Gazette and everything else that she did. It was really nothing short of phenomenal. I think Claudia Jones really is one of those women that you just kind of think, wow, like how and how? Because one day of research and I'm ready for like a 12-hour sleep. But
she was tireless. And unfortunately, I think that kind of led to her early death. I think it's kind of a lesson to sort of take care of yourself. And whilst there are these battles and these things that we have to fight for, you also have to look after yourself.
Definitely. Yeah, of course. It's interesting as well how then in that time she kind of moves with other women, other black women. You mentioned Amy Ashwood Garvey as well. I did wonder, and maybe I should have asked you this at the start, but I wonder how it's something, you know, your research covers black radical women, radical black women, radicalism. How do you define that? Or how do people define that, you know, other scholars, or what is your definition that you kind of carry when you're thinking about these women or that time period?
So I think that the term radical, I tend to agree with people like Carol Boyce Davies, who's written sort of two books on Claudia Jones and talks about Claudia Jones often. And I kind of see her as the scholar of Claudia Jones, just as an aside. But she sort of defines radicalism as sort of continuing the Black radical tradition, to kind of reimagining what society can be, and not just reforming, like to completely reimagine and think of new ways to create a more fair, equal and sort of humanistic world. And then also to sort of look at internationalism rather than insular politics, to not kind of shut ourselves off from the world. One of the interesting things that I came across a while back was an article from Islanda Robeson, or part of a book actually from Islanda Robeson, where she, I don't think I can quote it directly right now, but she talked about meeting a European when she went to Africa, specifically a colonialist is what she called him. And she sort of tells him off because he says, "Oh, your son, he's so smart. It's a pity that he's black." And she says, it's so out of pocket. It comes out of nowhere.
Did not say that.
Exactly. But she is so incensed. And she writes this really, really, I think this really powerful response to it. Because her response is not that, wow, that's just super racist, I can't believe you said that. She's kind of like, I can see right through you. I see the problem here. Like, you have shut yourself off from the rest of the world because you're so convinced that whiteness is superior and that the society is superior. And all you've done is kind of make a small box for yourself that you live in. So I think in terms of radicalism and that generation of radical women, they're always looking outwards and they're trying to expand and trying to sort of include the rest of the world in the fight for a fairer, more equal, less racist society. So I think when I think of radicalism, it's obviously like leftist radicalism that I'm looking at. So it just includes all these sort of these ideas that make not only the conditions of black women less exploitative, but also, I can't remember what the phrase is that Carol Boyce Davies used, but she said something like, when black women move, the rest of the world moves.
Yeah.
So when things get better for black women, things get better for everyone, because, you know, just by definition, but everything gets better. So that's what I think of when I think of the sort of, when I say black radical women, it is women who want these things for society and want these improvements that take much bigger leaps forward than sort of reformist, you know, we'll just change a line of the legislation and then things will be fine for 10 years. Mm. It's like, no, let's break all of this down.
Yeah.
And start again.
Yeah, absolutely. that is, I think, the attitude of a lot of radical Black women over the ages of over the last however many decades. It is that attitude of we need to burn this down and then build it back up to be equitable for all. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Wow. I'm learning a lot today. I'm enjoying this. I wondered, just because you think about, you know, a lot of women, and you've mentioned quite a few of them for us today. Are there any more that you have in mind that you want to tell us about? Just because I'm kind of now getting quite interested in all these people that I'm going to go research after this is finished.
So I can tell you, I mean, there are lots of women in my study. Another one who is really central, though, is Louise Thompson Patterson.
Yeah.
And in Britain, I don't think we really know much about her.
No.
She does sort of most of her activism in the US. But she is someone who really sort of, so my project looks from 1930 to the 1970s, and she is just like, you could draw a straight line through all of the things that she's involved in from 1930 to 1970. And she's a really phenomenal activist. She brings together lots of women, for example, in the 1950s, when a lot of Black left radicals, usually the men, are being arrested and accused of being communists and having to sort of go along to trials where they have to, you know, answer to senators and various other government officials to say that I'm not a communist. So Louise Thompson Patterson forms this organization of women that includes women like Claudia Jones, who, well, she's there from afar because she's on house arrest at the time, but she says, you know, I support you. I wish I could be there. And all of these women get together in 1951, and they decide that they're going to convene in Washington, D.C., and they go and they sort of speak out against the repression of the men in their lives, like various husbands or people that they were close with. And it's this moment that is just really inspiring, because it's women who sort of put themselves on the line. And they had been activists for a long time. But obviously, one of the things I'm trying to unpick in my project is the gendered aspect. So the way that a lot of the men get swept up and arrested and sent to prison. Claudia Jones is the only woman from that Black left radical network of women that is arrested and imprisoned and exiled eventually. So I'm really interested in how some of these women, you know, didn't have that kind of fate. But one of the things that's often argued is that Claudia Jones was, you know, she was an immigrant, and she also was arrested because she gave a speech on International Women's Day, which was specifically about uplifting women. So there's lots of aspects of gender and obviously the migrant experience that are tied up with Claudia Jones's experience. And I really recommend people like Carol Boyce-Davies to read more about that. But yeah, so anyway, Louise Thompson Patterson is someone that is really, really interesting. She also is part of Angela Davis's defense committee in the 1970s. Wow. So she's this woman who at multiple points really kind of assembles all of these people, Black left activists, into sort of defending various people at various times in the 20th century. And I think she's kind of, she deserves a lot more credit and a lot more praise, I think, than we're sort of aware of right now.
Absolutely. Well, again, another woman that I wasn't aware of. So it's so interesting that you think you know, when it comes to history anyway, you think you know something about a time period. Like if you said to me, oh, do you know anything about like radical Black movements in America, I'd be like, oh yeah, I know a few people, but we know nothing. We literally know nothing. There's just so much to learn, and it's like you don't even know what you don't know
even to bring it back to History Matters and even the Young Historians Project, there is it is such a process right now, at least in the last, you know, almost decade that these organizations have existed. It is so unbelievable how much we don't know, and we're still unpicking and learning new things every time we, you know, push out a journal or every time we start a new project. And it's still, you know, these things are not widely known. These things are sort of being pieced together by us bit by bit. So again, it kind of it shows how important these initiatives are, and the ways that we could, I guess, everyone, listeners, we could always be doing more.
Yeah, definitely. And that was a beautiful segue, Tion. Thank you so much. You can come back again, please. Okay. Because when it comes to the History Matters Journal, you know, it is a free and accessible, it's like the most accessible thing you can possibly read if you want something to read about Black British history. You know, it's literally available by PDF download online. You can read it from a phone, from a tablet, from a computer, whatever. So I believe the last publication came out quite recently.
Autumn 2022, yeah.
Fantastic. So there is that available. Obviously, you can go back and read other editions. The great thing about history is it's never out of date because it's literally always in the past. So you can go back and read those. I think the first one came out in autumn 2020. And since then, there have been several. So, Tion, as a kind of member of the editorial team, how is it that people listening today that might be thinking, I've got some historical research I've done, I would like to share this in this journal? And, you know, with, I think, thinking about what you said about having read publications and journals from the past, when you write for these journals that are eventually going to become part of history, you also are putting, whilst you're talking about an historical event or person, you're putting yourself into history in ways by, you know, marking down yourself as a person that's doing that work at that time. So it's a very good and important thing to do, I will say. How can people contribute, Tion, if they wanted to?
So there are a number of ways. We have sort of various social media. We have Twitter and we have Instagram. So you can send a message that way and just sort of say you're interested. The main way, I think, is to send an email. I believe the email is histmatters@gmail.com. And I think just to sort of give some context as well. So the journal is, I guess, technically an academic pursuit, but we accept submissions from literally anyone. As long as it's about Black British history, you can submit a piece of archival material. You can submit, you know, a short article. You could submit a review of a book on Black British history that you may have read. So there are lots of ways to get involved, and we cater to all kinds of age groups as well. If you're a school-aged person, or if you're someone who's at university, or if you're retired, you can also submit to the History Matters Journal. The main thing is that, as well as being available, this is a kind of democratized platform where people can talk about all aspects of Black British history. And obviously that lends itself well to people with all different kinds of experiences as well. So there's no strict kind of section of society that you have to have come from to submit to us.
Fantastic. Yeah. And if you missed that, it's historymatters_journal on Instagram and Matters History on Twitter. That is the kind of History Matters Collective, and then journal_matters. Is the Twitter for the journal if you want more information. They also have a website which you can look at. All of this information will be in the show notes for this episode if you do want to know more. Just let us know. We can point you in the right direction for this remarkable publication. So as we wrap up this episode, and I thank you so much, Tion, for being a part of it. Do you have any final words that you wanted to share about your work or anything that you're up to at the moment? I know you have a pamphlet that came out with your master's research about abolishing all prisons, examining the roots, which you can purchase. That will also be linked in the show notes for this episode if you wanted to. You know, Tion's work obviously at the moment is what she's spoken about today is focused on the article she had written for the History Matters Journal and for her PhD. But with most people that do PhDs and any kind of research, there's a whole load of research they've done before that to get to this point. So you can engage with that as well.
My Twitter account is probably where you can see the most about things that I research. I often share like little excerpts from archives.
It's a very good Twitter.
Or books that I'm currently reading. So if you're interested in anything that we've discussed, you'll probably see something there.
And your Twitter is at Tion Paris?
Yes.
N for Tion, double R for Paris.
Yep.
Fantastic. So thank you so much, Tion, for coming here today, recording this episode and sharing so much of your work. It really is remarkable, the work you're doing, and I can't wait to read what you have to say kind of as you go through the PhD and the final kind of work when that all kind of gets wrapped up and is all done. But thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I got to say, I'm a fan of your podcast, The History Hotline. Anyway, as I said already, Black British history was not something that I knew a lot about until I found your podcast.
Thank you.
And also got involved in these various other things. So
yeah, definitely.
Two thumbs up from me. Everyone go listen to other episodes. Absolutely. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here, honestly. Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you everyone for listening to the episode.
Bye.
Bye.
The History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of Black British history. The History Hotline is edited and hosted by Deanna Lynn Cook, and research is done by Zakia Riaz. To continue to support this podcast, please follow us on social media at The History Hotline on Instagram and at The History HL on Twitter. This podcast is available on all good podcast platforms. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.